So we hired this pilot to fly us in and drop us off on the edge of the river, because there's these landing strips cut through this whole part of Bolivia, because this is all also where all the cocaine is trafficked from the Andes to Brazil. So we're like, oh, great, we'll just use one of those landing strips. So we barely hit the landing because everything was flooded. So half of our runway was flooded. Survived that, hopped out of the plane, and of course, the landing strip we happened to choose was occupied by, you know, four narco traffickers. These guys, they had guns. They weren't pointing the guns at us, but they definitely had guns. And there was this very tense negotiation in Spanish about, like, when two white dudes just appear on one of these landing strips, it usually means they're DEA. So, like, we had to explain that we're not DEA. We're actually, like, looking for cacao. And
yeah, cacao, not cacao.
Source of constant confusion. Because, yeah, they're both right there. Coca? No, cacao. Really? Cacao? Don't you mean coca? No, we really mean cacao.
I'm Dylan Thuris, and this is Atlas Obscura, a celebration of the world's strange, incredible, and wondrous places. Today, we're going to be talking with Rowan Jacobson. Rowan is a food journalist, and he's the host of a podcast called Wild Chocolate. And that's what we're here to talk to him about, because that show follows his multi-year quest into the Amazon, all in pursuit of a mythical bar of chocolate, all to find the origins, to learn about its dark history and its potential to save parts of the rainforest. More after this. For your next vacation spot, check out Texas for their vast landscape of culture, regions, destinations, and activities. Explore 350 miles of coastline and every kind of hiking trail, from strenuous to wheelchair accessible. Enjoy world-famous barbecue and Tex-Mex, and check out thrilling cowboy experiences. Travel Texas even offers an online trip builder that allows users to generate a custom, visually led trip matched to their unique interests. Visit traveltexas.com/get-your-own to get the only trip to Texas that matters, yours.
Kent State, their name does something for people. When people hear that you're a Kent State grad, they're like, oh, yeah, I have a lot of nurses like that. And they're good nurses. They want to hire you because you're from Kent State in their nursing program. They teach the art of nursing. They teach the therapeutic communication. They teach how to really care for the person and not just knowledge. Even when it's hard in classes, even when this is a new adjustment, the school itself has the people and the support that you need to be the best nurse that you can be.
Begin at Kent State University.
So Rowan is a food writer. And when you look at the stuff that Rowan's written about, it feels a little bit like a menu for some of the most decadent, fancy, expensive things you could order. We're talking about oysters and truffles and fine wines.
Do you think of yourself as kind of like a fancy food guy?
You know, I don't. And it's funny because, yeah, I do end up writing about some of those, the snootier things sometimes. But I think those are the foods that are getting more attention paid to them. Like, and usually because there was something there to begin with that made people extra excited, which is how they got to be expensive in the first place. So it's not the snootiness. It's more like the depth of the story to tell, I think.
In fact, most of Rowan's reporting has not been about white tablecloths and luxury tastings. It's taken him to some really extreme places in pursuit of these stories. He followed rhino poachers in India, salmon fishermen in villages in Alaska.
I spent 2 weeks volunteering on a NOAA fishing vessel in the Gulf of Maine, processing fish each day in the hull of the ship for 12-hour shifts. So I volunteered for that, which turned out to be completely miserable, which was kind of the point.
Recently, Rowan has spent a lot of time getting bitten by bugs in the Amazon, because for the past decade or so, Rowan has been chasing one story in particular. It all started with a book he was writing about what food writers call terroir.
you know, like the taste of place. Like mm-hmm. most famously, it's a wine thing, but there's lots of foods where they're inseparable from their place. And chocolate is one of those. So I was writing about chocolate and learning more about it. And so I was like, you know, like stalking these websites, like super geeky chocolate nerd websites. And they're all raving about this new bar called Cru Sauvage. Like Sauvage means wild in French. And it was a Swiss bar. And they're like, oh my God, this tastes so different.
At the time, it was not easy to track down a bar of this so-called wild chocolate. But after a lot of sleuthing, he found a supplier.
Yeah, I remember it was $13, but then it was from Switzerland. So then I had to pay another $13 for the shipping, which seemed insane in 2009. I was like, oh, it's research. I got to do it.
When the wild chocolate bar finally arrived on Rowan's doorstep, he peeled back the layer of crisp gold foil that it was wrapped in.
It was this long, thin plank, and it had a long feather embossed on it all the way along the bar. And I was like, wow, it really does taste different. It was delicious. It was actually really smooth. It didn't have any bitterness, even though the cocoa content was really high. It was just different. It just had this depth to it.
Rowan later wrote about this first taste of wild chocolate for Outside Magazine. And I'm going to quote that article here. He wrote, "It was delicious for sure, but that was almost beside the point. There was something else going on, something metaphysical. I don't really have the word for it. All I can say is that compared to all the chocolate I have known, this one tasted real." What is wild cacao? What is that as compared to kind of what we think of as chocolate?
So this wild cacao is the original wild strains that evolved in the Amazon. So they have not been bred for sun exposure and high yield and all the things that we do to pretty much every crop when we domesticate it. Everyone in the chocolate industry, they didn't know there was such a thing as wild cacao. They'd be like, you know, what are you talking about? You know, it's domesticated. It was domesticated thousands of years ago. But some people just in the past 20 years have realized that the wild strains were still there in the Amazon and that you could make chocolate out of them and that it actually turned out to be some of the best chocolate on the planet.
I'm going to jump in to add here that cacao is an incredibly sensitive crop. We've actually done another episode about this on the podcast, if you're interested. It's about the chocpocalypse. There's a link in the show notes. But basically, cacao is grown in just three regions in the world: South and Central America, West Africa, and Southeast Asia. And in all of those places, people are going to incredible lengths to make sure that plants are protected from disease and adapted to grow in very specific conditions. So, cacao plants haven't just been domesticated. They are also these incredibly fussy hothouse flowers.
So it's the common wisdom was basically that wild cacao was effectively extinct, right? Like people didn't think it was a thing you could go and find, really.
Totally. People in the industry had no clue because they had never seen it. There was no industry that was accessing it. In fact, one of the guys I chronicled in the podcast, who was sort of the first Westerner to meet the people in Bolivia who were still using it and who realized that it was actually really good. He spent a couple of years like going around from like trade show to trade show and going to all these chocolate companies and saying like, here, check out these cocoa beans. They're wild and they're awesome. And nobody would give him the time of day because the beans looked a little weird. They're really small. And they just thought he was making a story up about wild cacao.
So what is it that makes it so special? What is it that gives it this kind of quality that someone would spend years basically going around and trying to find it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And no one knows quite why it sort of like went down this way. But the varieties of cacao that we bred to be grown as monocrops for basically, you know, industrial agricultural production and sun exposure, they ended up having a lot of bitterness and astringency to them. And they just sort of lost the really good flavored stuff that the old varieties had had. And then the obvious question is, well, if someone was like, you know, going to farm this stuff, why would they have selected versions that didn't taste very good? But they picked varieties that, you know, could take the sun and wouldn't die from disease, basically. And cacao was literally a commodity, you know, bought 100,000 tons at a time. So farmers made good decisions and the industry made good decisions to just pick whatever yielded the most. But then that was how we wound up with cacao that didn't taste very good.
So after tasting this mind-blowingly smooth, rich, naturally sweet chocolate, Rowan made it his mission to find the guy from the chocolate trade shows. The guy who is claiming he had gotten his hands on this real wild cacao. That guy was Volker Lehmann.
And I could tell he was a little kooky and a little cocky, because I had told him that, like, these people I was talking to in the industry said, there's no such thing as wild cacao. And he's like, oh yeah, it's wild. You come down here. I'm actually going, taking this river trip into the jungle to meet with this indigenous group called the Yirrkare, who like have all this cacao that grows around them. And I'm hoping to be able to pay them to harvest it. So we're going to have these negotiations. And so that, you know, it kind of set off all my like quest buttons. And if you're a writer, you're always looking for a good quest narrative.
To meet up with Volker, he had to take four different airplanes that got smaller and sketchier with each leg of the trip. And when he and Volker reached the end of the roads at the outskirts of the rainforest, they hopped into canoes, which took them deeper into the jungle. Then there were more planes. And of course, that exciting encounter with the narco traffickers.
We had to end up having to pay them like a, you know, a use fee for the landing strip. And then they're like, all right, you guys are cool. Met our guy with the dugout canoe. And then finally we're on the river and we go to these meetings with these indigenous groups. So that was like day one, you know? So it was definitely not a comfortable trip.
Definitely an exciting start. So from there, once you'd kind of, you know, landed and gotten into it, were you able to go and find what you had gone in search of?
Yeah, we were, you know, we saw them from the boat that just like lining the riverbanks, and then there'd be people in there. Everything was flooded at the time. So there'd be people in there harvesting the pods and just sticking them in their canoes. It's so beautiful. Like the trees themselves are amazing. They have broad leaves, almost like a magnolia tree or something, and smooth trunks with like white spots on them. And yeah, the trees themselves are maybe like 20, 30 feet tall, but the pods are amazing. They look like Nerf footballs. Like they're those colors. They're like bright yellow and orange and red. And they're about that size, like almost like a delicata squash. And then of course, you do this whole alchemy process where you take these white beans that don't have much flavor yet, and you ferment them and dry them and roast them. And suddenly get this completely different product at the end, and that product is delicious. So it's just like it takes the essence of the rainforest and really just like concentrates it into this amazing experience. So it really is it's got a lot of character.
When you got into the Amazon and were talking to folks there, like, what was their take on wild cacao? Like, this is not a surprise to them that it's growing there.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. Because, right, like, the know-it-all, you know, Western chocolate industry is like, oh, there's no such thing as wild cacao. Meanwhile, for literally 400 years, if not 4,000 years, these people in Bolivia have just been doing it, you know,
right,
and drinking it locally. And they're like, the way they were doing it was not, it was not turning out a product that would meet the expectations of sort of like a Western chocolate consumer, but it was like they're making it was a drinking chocolate that was their cultural tradition. So yeah, so they were just kind of like, you know, in this very isolated spot doing this thing for centuries. So it was pretty funny when suddenly all these Westerners started popping up and going crazy for the stuff that they just considered, you know, another bean that you pick in the forest, one of many.
Tell me a little bit about the Yirrkare and like what's happening to the cacao that's now being harvested.
Yeah, so it's become a big deal. So throughout this the lower section of Bolivia, the jungle section, quite a bit of cacao is coming out, and that cacao is now finding its way to both Europe and U.S. chocolate makers. So it's really good for the people there and for the rainforest in general, because it provides an income for the standing forest. And as you know, the big issue in the Amazon right now is deforestation. Mm. The easy money is to burn down your forest and bring cattle in, right? So the way to fight that is to come up with ways for people to make their incomes off the standing forest. And cacao is being discovered as one of the best ways to do that. So that's why people in Peru and Colombia, these indigenous groups, are interested as well, because they're feeling these pressures, all these other people who want to get a hold of this land. And if they can make a living selling, harvesting wild cacao and selling it, then that gives them a much better standing, a better way to hang in there. Now, it's become such a big deal that there's a little bit of, protectiveness, understandably so, about these chocolatales, as they call them, these chocolate forests.
Hmm.
Like, they're now protected as almost like World Heritage sites, where you can't cut them down, even no matter who you are. But right now, they're all that chocolate is being bought for export at this point, because the prices are so high. So it's kind of this classic situation where the price has gone up, where local people probably can't afford those beans anymore, you know?
Right. Has it changed the dynamics of who's kind of involved?
There is some unsavoriness involved. As far as I can tell, there's unsavoriness involved with every commercial transaction in that part of the world. But remember, this is also the place where all of the cocaine is still flowing through freely.
Right.
So cacao is still like ridiculously unimportant on an economic level compared to coca. So the unsavory people are all drawn to the coca end of things. So the people who end up doing cacao are ones who are not in it for the money at some level.
So after you did all this and you've made multiple trips and you're like going again shortly, like, what are you still looking for? Where does this story and work take you from here?
Yeah, I've gotten sucked in a little bit where I'm no longer a completely objective journalist. I'm a tiny bit of an activist too, because I really want to see this thing grow and get more people aware of it.
Rowan is really optimistic about the future of wild chocolate, because the very things that make it valuable and delicious make its exploitation and the destruction of the landscape kind of impractical. It tastes different because it's wild, because it's growing naturally. If you were to try and domesticate it or farm it industrially, you would just end up recreating the modern chocolates that we already have. And because it's rare, it's also valuable. It gives people who own the land a reason to preserve the rainforest instead of cutting down the trees to graze cattle or farm other crops. So if you're feeling a little flush and a little curious, wild chocolate is out there, made from the pure and wild beans sourced from all over the Amazon, and a little taste of what chocolate once was, the great, great ancestor of every Hershey's bar and M&M. A taste some might even call metaphysical.
Our podcast is a co-production of Atlas Obscura and Witness Docs. This episode was produced by
Sarah Wyman.
The production team includes
Doug Baldinger,
Chris Naka,
Camille Stanley,
Willis Ryder Arnold,
Manolo Morales,
Baudelaire,
Gianna Palmer,
Tracy Samuelson,
Gabby Gladney.
Our technical director is
Casey Holford.
This episode was sound designed and mixed by
Luce Fleming.
And our theme and end credit music is by Sam Tyndall. I'm Dylan Thuris, wishing you all the wonder in the world. I will see you next time.
Witness Docs from Stitcher.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I think we all know that one of the greatest shows on television is Antiques Roadshow. And if you've ever wondered what happens once the cameras turn off on America's favorite antique show,
you have got to check out season 5 of Detours. You get behind the scenes and dive into the dirt of the treasures found on Antiques Roadshow. You join Adam Monahan, host and longtime producer of GBH's Antiques Roadshow, as he reveals more of the never-before-told stories, the juicy gossip, the fakes, the fumbles, the unforgettable moments. Listen to Detours now, available wherever you get your podcasts.